Welcome to the Growing Leaders Podcast. I'm Mary Steves, and I'm here today with our fearless leader, Dr. Tim Elmore. In this month's episode, we welcome to the discussion Dr. Corey C. Miller, professor and author of Generation Z Goes to College. Today, we're going to focus on her research findings on Generation Z that led her and one of her colleagues to write Generation Z Goes to College. Whether you're leading them now or will be in the future, you'll want to gain the insights from this discussion between Corey and Tim.
Thanks, Mary. Corey, thanks for carving out some time to be with us today.
Great. Thanks, Tim, so much for having me.
Yeah. You and I have talked before, and I think we both have a lot of energy around helping educators especially, but also employers, really understand the emerging generation. So we're going to talk about that today. What does Generation Z look like? But Corey, if you don't mind, would you just take a minute and share a little bit about your story, just so our listeners know who you are and kind of what you've done?
Great. Yes, absolutely. So I have actually been working in higher education for over 20 years, most of which was in student affairs. I've worked in career services. The lion's share of my time has been in leadership programs, but I've done service learning work, academic advising, and residence life. And so I have my finger on the pulse of what happens kind of on the student services, student affairs side of higher ed. In addition to that, in many of those years, I was actually teaching courses at the same time. So I've been teaching for quite a while and decided to finally make the leap into a formal faculty position about a year ago. And so now I work at Wright State University as an assistant professor in organizational leadership.
Wonderful. What a cool job. If I can
just
say
it is a cool job.
That's neat. That's fun. Well, I want to talk about Generation Z and your book, Generation Z Goes to College. Can we start by just talking about what sparked your interest in studying Generation Z?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I was working at the University of Arizona in the summer of 2013, and we were starting to get some new applicants for our leadership programs. And the students had to fill out essays, and they had to come to orientation. And for some reason, I just felt like things might... It was a little bit of a different kind of group of students than I'd ever noticed. Mm-hmm. And so I looked online and I said, what's going on? What should we be expecting of this new cohort of students? At that time, I didn't even know it was a generation.
Yeah.
And found out that there was an actual generational shift that year. Now, it isn't typically that abrupt, but it was enough for me to notice that something was different.
Mm-hmm.
And after doing some research online, I was able to find some market research, some youth research about this new generation called Generation Z or Generation IY or Digital
mm-hmm.
Native.
Yeah.
They're called a lot of things. And from that point on, I was quite interested and had one of my colleagues, Megan Grace, kind of jump on board and said, I'm interested too. And so after a year of doing some research of other people's studies, we decided to put together our own study in fall of 2014 and thus emerged a book from that. So I never intended it to kind of get that far, but it was exciting as we learned more and more. It was, you know, kind of going down the rabbit hole. It was more and more interesting and fascinating about these particular students in higher ed.
Right. No doubt about it. And you were one of the early pioneers. I think when you and I talked last, you said there's quite a bit of market research, but there wasn't necessarily academic research done yet. So how cool to be a part of a study. I loved what I read. Thank you for doing that, by the way. can we start by just talking about what were some of the surprises from your research on Generation Z? Was there anything that popped up and you went, wow, I didn't realize that?
Well, you know what was most interesting to me is I thought Generation Z might have been kind of more of millennials, just millennials kind of enhanced. And,
yes,
and I found that wasn't actually the case in many situations. I mean, they're technologically savvy and those kinds of things like millennials, but their perspectives and their outlooks are incredibly different. If you kind of look at their upbringing, most of them have Generation X parents. And that's significant because what you're seeing is that these students are having a little bit more independence, a little bit more autonomy, pragmatism, realism than I was expecting.
Yeah.
And they're growing up in an era in which they sort of have to have that to survive. I mean, and so for me, I was surprised initially, but then once I thought about it, I thought, well, this makes a lot of sense. And so for me, that was probably the biggest surprise. I also thought that there would be some things, again, that we'd have to continue to reiterate, like social media, that they're all over social media, but they don't have any privacy settings, and they're going to tell everybody everything. And I realized very quickly through my research and a number of other studies that they're very private with social media. They use it, but they're very particular about it. And things, again, that I wasn't really expecting from from students that were 17, 18 years old who were, you know, participating in our study.
Yeah, that's interesting. And there has been a shift. We've seen the same thing. And it does make sense, if I can just volley back, that the majority of their lives are spent on this side of the 21st century. So, and it's been a very different last 15 years than the previous 15 years. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that they would be, yeah, a little more savvy, perhaps, than those, the millennials, that everything was awesome and you know, we're going to change the world by noon on Friday. And, yeah, a little more pragmatism.
Right.
So let's talk for a minute about what should college educators know about Generation Z? If you were to sit down, have a Starbucks, and you had just 5 minutes, what would you say that a college educator ought to know about this new cohort of students?
Well, one thing I think that and this wasn't from our study, but from subsequent studies, was that you'll find that these students are less risk takers. Mm. And so they may tend to have less disciplinary issues. And so for my fellow friends in student affairs, you might enjoy hearing this, that they identify as loyal and responsible, and they're very purposeful and wanting to come in and get an education. Now, again, I'm talking more thematically as an entire generation. There's individual students who are going to still, you know, make some not so good choices. But you will find that they do identify as a responsible generation. They also learn very differently than previous generations. This is fascinating to me. They grew up in the K-12 era, in which it was, you know, applied problem-based learning, a lot of group work, service learning was required, and they're coming to college sort of exhausted of that. And I never thought that I'd actually have students who say, I like to have a lecture. That would be refreshing. But they still like applied learning, but they really do like a lot of independent solo work. Mm-hmm. And another thing I think that's important for college educators to know is that just because this is a technologically savvy generation does not make them adept at every platform that's out there. Nor does it make technology accessible to every Generation Z student. There are some that do not have smartphones, and there are some that did not have internet access growing up. And so assuming that students all know how to use all technology, we have to just be mindful of that sure. many do, but not all do. And then a few other things that I think are really key here is that they because they've had access to what seems like infinite amount of information, they have done a lot of self-learning, which is great, but they come to college having a lot of misinformation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've talked about with millennials specifically is having to help them develop critical thinking skills so that they know what information is legitimate and not on the internet as they look it up. And although we still need to do that with Generation Z, we have an additional step that we need to do, which is not only do we have to say, okay, how do you recognize credible information, but now how do you go back and figure out what you have learned and if that was credible or not. And so there's like an additional step of unlearning that we have to do with our students as they come to college.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And if you think about the era that they've grown up in, you're going to have that conversation. We thought if it's on the internet, it's true, you know?
Right,
and
you right.
And both know that's not necessarily true. Yeah. one of our earlier conversations, Corey, I think we had was like, when does Gen Z begin? And I think you have kind of worked off of research that said about the mid-90s, 95, others a little bit later. Talk a little bit about that, and then I want to get into what high school and middle school educators should know about Gen Z.
Sure. Well, you know, just like any generation, nobody has agreed on the start and end dates. You can even look back to baby boomers, and there's still solidified start or end date. We've been going off the definition of 1995. We've had most everything we've found has said 1995. Some is 94 and some is 96. So 95 seemed like a good place to start. But now things are coming out that say that that generation doesn't even start until 2010, which feels very, very late. But I do get the question is, why was the millennial generation so short compared to other generations? And a lot of it has to do with this idea that generations aren't necessarily like actual birth generations anymore. Yeah. Generations are contexts of time in which significant things happen that change the perspectives and actions of the people who exist in those. And so, you know, we may find that generations are even shorter in the future because of the way technology is growing and enhancing.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Were there any landmark events that made the mid-90s the start time for a new batch of kids, would you say?
Well, interestingly, what I continue to find is it's not so much when they were born, it's when they came of age when 9/11 happened.
Okay, yes.
And the oldest of Generation Z was in kindergarten when 9/11 happened. Mm. So basically, it would be a generation that doesn't remember that.
Yeah.
And that's where they've sort of cut it off.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so let's talk about high school and middle school educators. I know that's a little bit younger than the students that you've worked with, but what would you advise a high school faculty or principal, a faculty member or principal who's working with kids today? What insights would you give them about young teens and maybe mid-teens?
Sure. I've definitely got some things around learning and then also just around their experiences in school, too. When we did our study, we captured the information within the first 6 weeks of college. So a lot of them were reflecting on their high school experiences specifically to respond. And so one of the things that I think is important for learning is going to be, I'm calling it the Netflix approach to studying, this idea of binging. Now, this isn't new to this generation, the idea of binging and binge studying, but things like Netflix and staying up all night and watching an entire season of something just kind of exacerbates this idea that you can consume that much content in a short period of time effectively. And so helping students, especially younger kids, when even in elementary school and middle school, start thinking of good ways to pace out their studying so they can build the good habits. Because by the time we're getting them there, again, they have this binging approach. And we know that combined with procrastination means that they pull all-nighters. And that's not new. But this is a good opportunity for us to kind of curb that before they come to college.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, kind of like trying to eat all your meals in January for the year. And it just doesn't quite work.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Another couple things that I think are interesting is that we ask lots of questions about community engagement and service learning. And most of the students had indicated that they did service learning in high school, as a matter of fact, a big majority of them. Hmm. But most of them said that they were required to do it and that it alluded to the idea that they potentially would not have done it otherwise and did not necessarily seek it out as a way of engaging their community. And we know that service learning is a valuable contribution both for students and for the communities they serve. But these students are doing other things on the side, and that was fascinating to me. So you've got the millennials, which is a very volunteer-oriented generation where, they might work all week and then on Saturday go volunteer at a food bank. Whereas Gen Z, they go to school or they work all week, and then what they do is they might have to do service learning. And then what they want to do is on the side, they're doing things like serving on boards of nonprofits at young ages. They're inventing things that are changing the world. They're doing things that they're not, quote, getting academic credit for. And my gathering of this is that they would like to expand the notion of service learning and what counts in high school. I had a student who was a first year student, and she came to me and said, can I count service hours required for this class as running my nonprofit that I started in high school? And I thought, well, I was a little chagrined about that. Yes, you can. And so thinking about what are ways that we can help students see service learning as more of a sustainable life practice in areas that they like. If you're a techie person and you just want to sit and develop an app to enhance literacy, is that not service? Thinking about how we do that, especially because they're coming out of high school, so many of them doing service, thinking about how we can tap into their passions and their skill sets to really get them to serve in ways that can make a difference at the same time as fueling who they are.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. In fact, I'm just thinking about all the service learning programs generally run by Gen X or baby boomers who have our own little box or package of what it should look like. And they're naturally going to think outside of that box. So that makes total sense. In fact, I'll tell you another thought that raced through my mind as you were talking. One of the things that probably leads to their extreme pragmatism or just savviness is maybe, I don't know, maybe a 17-year-old today had an older brother or sister that bought into the idea, just do this, this, and this, and you're going to have a great job. Go to college and blah, blah, blah. And they went to college, and now they've got this $28,000 debt, and they're a barista at Starbucks or whatever, but it didn't work exactly like baby boomer mom and dad said. And so they're going to go, I'm going to figure this out myself a little differently, perhaps. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. A lot of people have brought up the idea of the impact of older siblings on Generation Z's outlook. And we know that we didn't really study that, and I haven't seen a lot of studies about that, but we know that the influence of parents' decisions around things like you're talking about do influence the perspectives of the children themselves. We had a number of them talked about how they watched their families or their friends' families lose their homes in the housing crisis, lose their jobs. They're very aware of what's happening around them, and many of them felt a direct effect of that. And so I could certainly see how maybe especially a late millennial who graduated from college. I mean, the early millennials came out and could, you know, in many cases, we had a really good job market. Yeah. The later millennials just struggled, and some moved back home. And then, you know, so they're watching this. Yeah. They're seeing this, and they're realizing, I have to be very, very postured and methodical about what I'm going to do so that I can not be in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So I want to move forward to a very specific question, Corey, that I think will be fun for you to talk about since you've been in student affairs. If a university educator who was extremely interested in retention, student retention at a higher ed institution, ask you, okay, you understand Gen Z, how can we increase retention at our school? What are some things perhaps that are new thoughts or maybe slightly new thoughts that could increase retention on a college campus?
I think, you know, if we start looking at the students themselves and kind of who they are as people, and then we look at the structures around them, there's two different pieces I'd recommend. One, around the students themselves. We have more students coming into higher education with mental health issues than ever before.
Yes, yes.
Yet we don't have the infrastructure in our counseling services to provide ongoing long-term support for these students. And so if they are out of state or even can't afford it, they're not getting that counseling support that they need. Yeah. And without that, you know, thinking just, obviously, they're not worried about their test on Friday because some of them are having a hard time even coping in general.
Yes.
And
so
we've got to figure out how to do after-hours programs in our counseling center, long-term, you know, caseloads, weekend hours, crisis. I mean, things that are beyond you get your 8 free appointments and then you're done your college career. That's the first one. And I think tied to that, too, is another thing is a lot of these students are very concerned about safety. They've grown up in an era of school shootings being the norm. They've had many of them talked about being cyber stalked, cyber bullied, worried about violence in general. And they're coming to campus and they want to know how safe campus is. And they want to know, are there safety training programs? What can I attend to learn more about this? Are there blue lights on campus? And I know colleges, having worked in student affairs, I've had this message told to me that we need to not emphasize safety programs because it might make parents and students think our campus is unsafe, and that's why we have those programs. And, you know, I'm going to counter that is, you know, we have got to be able to provide programs that make, you know, help students feel safe or give them the tools and resources they need. So again, these are basic necessities, mental health counseling and safety. So these are pieces I think beyond, and we can continue to talk about the cost of higher ed and that came up and that's their number one concern. But some of the things that campuses can do right out of the gate, I think these are two really, really critical ones.
No doubt about it. Yeah. This is good. This is so practical. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
The third piece that's going to kind of blow people's minds is there's an assumption that because they're digitally connected and savvy that they really like that online access. And they do. They like 24-hour access. I mean, they can get on Amazon and buy a bicycle at 3:00 in the morning.
Yeah.
But they crave face-to-face interactions with campus professionals.
Yeah.
And we know from the literature that connection to the campus is important, and that connection has not changed with this generation. They still want to sit down with an academic advisor. They still want to go into the health center and meet with somebody. They don't want to do a chat with a librarian. Although these things are helpful and they like it for quick responses, but for building relationships and long-term connection, they really don't want to lose the face-to-face. Those are some of the critical pieces I see. And I think summing it all up with the one piece that just kind of brings it all home is this idea is they, in the end, these students have to see a value in college education.
Yeah, right.
They are taking out a lifetime debt. Mm-hmm. And if we don't do a good job of helping them understand not just the marketability, but their own personal value of the experience of the 4, 5, 6, however many years they're in college, they might not come. And frankly, I know I've said this and people say, no, that wouldn't happen. Everybody, you know, they've got to go to college to get a good job. Well, welcome to the world where we're leaving a service you know, a service economy and we're entering an idea economy, yeah, you don't have to go to college for that.
That's right, yeah.
You know, you can make solar panels and make $100,000 in a year, you know, and these students know that.
Yeah.
So we have got to do a better job of saying why college is important.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I'm even thinking, as you said that, we live in a day, thanks to social media, YouTube, et cetera, if you've got a song you've written, you don't need to go to the, you know, record album company and get a label. You just put it on YouTube and, you know, Justin Bieber's discovered, you know, and so forth.
Exactly.
So it's a different day, and we have got to figure that out so we can educate them. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add one more thing to that real quick is, you know, we're in an entrepreneurial age where many people, like you're mentioning about putting a song on YouTube, they're putting photographs on Instagram, they're putting their artwork on Etsy, they're selling things on Craigslist. You don't even have to, you can be an entrepreneur and not even have to have a website anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're seeing people who have a car being Uber drivers, people renting out the rooms of Airbnb. This is a generation that sees entrepreneurship as a viable career choice.
Yeah.
And when we talk about having our students in college, many of them want to go work for themselves. As a matter of fact, a good share of them want to do that. So one of the other things that would be really helpful, I think, to retain these students is to provide entrepreneurship classes in college that aren't designated for business majors.
Yeah.
They are for the dance major who wants to run a dance studio later on. They need to be able to come to college and see that what they're learning is going to be helpful to their dreams and their goals.
Makes total sense. That's good. Real quick, one of the most intriguing parts of your book for me, since you and I both have a keen interest in this topic, is leadership. You had a section just on Gen Z and how they view leadership. Could you take just a quick second and talk a bit about what the things you and Megan discovered about Gen Z and leadership that might be a little different than millennials?
Sure. One of the key findings that we had is we asked students to identify what roles they play in groups, and we asked them, you know, do you always, often, or so forth play in groups? And we gave them choices of doing, thinking, relating, and leading. And these, we gave them some definitions of these. And by far, the role that they play most in groups and that they like to play most in groups is doing. They like to actually be action-oriented, roll up their sleeves, get it done. Leading was the fourth. It was the last one.
Yeah,
statistically, significantly, the lowest.
Yeah.
And my question is, and I, this is going to take, of course, you know, whenever you do research, you raise more questions than answers, is that, you know, do they resonate with the word leader? If you look around them, they're seeing kind of two bombarding images of leaders. One is, you know, think about their youth leaders that are on the big screen. You've got the Harry Potters who are fighting Voldemort. You've got, you know, Katniss Everdeen, who's, you know, Hunger Games. I mean, these are, you know, kids that are martyrs for large-scale communities, you know, saving the community. It seems like a pretty lofty thing to live up to in that sense.
Yeah.
But then you've got this other competing view of leadership, which is these political leaders around them. And, you know, we did our study in 2014, and I'm not sure their faith in politics has grown from that point to now. I'm thinking, you know, they noted it as corrupt and, you know, just cronyism and untrustworthy, and that they have no interest in participating in it. They don't see political leaders as role models.
Yeah.
I mean, one after the other said this, and like I said, I can't imagine that is any greater now. And so you have this bombardment of images of one is leaders are this person that is, you know, in some sense their characteristics are unattainable, yet they are corrupt. And I don't know where I fit in that, so I'm not going to connect with it at all.
Well, this makes total sense, and this makes our work, you and me both, a little more challenging because I do believe they have gifts and they have something to offer, but maybe we have to use new language and paradigms to help them see it's okay to step out and solve problems and serve people and not call yourself a leader, perhaps. I don't know. That's going to be a different day. Okay, I've got one more gigantic question, Corey, that I'd love to ask you. The people listening to you right now are generally adults who care about the next generation. They're educators, they're athletic coaches, they're parents. As you study Gen Z, how would you say today's students prefer to learn and be communicated with and be instructed? What would be some tips you would give that are really practical based on your research?
I think for me, and this was one of the most stunning findings of our research, and then we found it in a number of different other studies as well, is these students prefer intrapersonal learning. They like journals, reflection, quiet solo projects. They like pre-learning. They like to be given something to learn before they come to class. My students ask me, can I have the PowerPoints before class so I can read them? Are there things that I can study before I come? They enjoy flipped classrooms where, you know, they can do some of the homework before they come together. Yeah. They like interpersonal learning. They do not like group work. Like at all. And they gave many reasons why don't. They, you know, part of it's the accountability of other people in the group, which is not not atypical. Right. But they did say some other things is, you know, I like to be able to focus, go my own pace, go my own direction, choose my own interests. And I don't want to work with groups to do that. And then some of them said for in the classroom, when they're asked to have group discussions, that if they don't have an opportunity to think first before they're asked to discuss with a partner or in a group, that they feel a little, you know, off their game.
Yeah,
they want to have 2-3 minutes to jot down some ideas on a piece of paper, think through it, or come to class prepared to engage in a group discussion. But they feel sort of thrown to the wolves if they have to do it right there. And I know that's a very common pedagogy for many people who teach or run workshops or trainings. It's here's some information. Now, quick, get in a group and talk about it. And they say, I would learn better if you gave me a few minutes to chew on it myself. And so that was interesting to me. And but at the same time, as they like individual solo work, and they're not a huge fan of group work, they are social learners. They like to learn next to each other, but they don't necessarily want to learn with each other. I want to get a study group together, and we'll all sit together. Yeah. We won't talk. We'll just all individually study, but in the same space.
Yeah, interesting. But there is a difference.
There is. Yeah. Yep.
Very interesting. Corey, this has been so rich. Thank you for carving out some time and just sharing really out of the overflow of your own learning and your own practice. I have so appreciated your book. I'm so glad that our friend Carrie Priest got us together. And it's just I just appreciate you taking time today very, very much.
Well, thank you so much for listening to all my thoughts. I appreciate that.
You bet. You bet. Have a great, great day.
Thank you. You too.
Dr. Corey C. Miller, thank you so much. And Tim, I appreciate the conversation that we've had today. Tim, I'd love to dive a little bit deeper and peel back the layers on this subject. And we added a new part of our podcast about how to practically apply what we've discussed. And Corey had mentioned a lot of data that has been following Generation Z. So how does that data help us lead them?
Well, Mary, you and I both know we just tried to tackle a gigantic topic in that conversation with Corey. I so appreciate her data, and I want to play off of a few things she said. Our focus groups that we have hosted have told us some of the very same things, that these kids are very different than the millennials. So they're not just an extension of the millennial generation. Mm-hmm. So three words come to my mind that are I think are great issues or takeaways that we can practice and maybe focus on as we think about coaching, teaching, and parenting this next generation. The first one is the word integration. If you stop and think about it, this population of kids, really who've grown up since the 21st century has dawned, they're the first generation that grew up completely with social media. It's been around their entire lives.
Yeah.
And it's just grown with every year. There's new app. There's a new way to create a new persona on Instagram or Snapchat or Facebook or whatever. One of our focus groups, the student said, I forget who I am sometimes.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's just crazy. So the whole idea of integration is let's help them integrate their persona and not be 15 people, perhaps, but create a brand for themselves. We talk about this all the time when we talk about career-ready students. What brand are you communicating? What label are you wearing when you say your name? And perhaps an employer hears you, looks up your social media site, and maybe doesn't hire you because they don't like what they just saw. So I think the whole idea of integration is huge. And if for no other reason, it's huge because of the angst and the depression that so many in this generation experience. It's just, it's unnecessary. Mm-hmm. But we have a world full of angst because of the voices screaming at us and the different personas we've created. So integration would be one. A second word, I think, is inspiration. Corey talked about how they watched their millennial older brother or sister or whatever do some things that weren't good, that have debt now after college or whatever. And so they're less apt to maybe be brave or step out and do something reckless. Now, the good news is we may have less disciplinary problems. The bad news is we need these generation of kids to try entrepreneurial ventures and to not be afraid or be risk averse. Mm. So I think we're going to need to be inspirers in the classroom, on the athletic field, in the youth group, wherever we find ourselves, to inspire them to step out and take a risk, not reckless, but calculated. Mm. So the whole idea of how can we do that is going to be a looming question we need to answer. Mm. And then the third one is the whole idea of identification. The more we study and the more we spend time with Generation Z students, the more I'm convinced that identity is a gigantic issue that they're wrestling with to a greater degree than adolescents did perhaps in the past. Mm. Times were simpler in the 1950s or 60s, you know, back in my day, but... But in so many ways, the issue of identity is very pluralistic today. And I mentioned the persona thing, where they might be one persona and one app and then another one on another app. That's only the beginning. I think it creates all kinds of challenges that I think caring adults can help them really zoom in on who are you and who do you want to be. And that means who do you associate with? Are you aware of your gifts and your passions? So awareness is another issue. Achievement. What have you done that's better than average? Mm. You know, I think that's a huge issue. Those were simpler issues in the past. This is my family, you know, and that's my name, my family name. Well, now it may be a blended family or a broken family. So it's just a tougher issue today. Mm. So I think integration, let's help them integrate their persona and come up with a brand. Inspiration, let's help them take brave steps when they might be tempted to play it safe and maybe just play a video game. And then number three, identification. Let's help them assume a very clear identity based on who they truly are. If we can do that, we may see the greatest population of kids graduate from school that we've seen to date.
Tim, thanks so much for the insight on this conversation today. And if you would like to continue the conversation, please connect with Tim and Growing Leaders on Facebook and Twitter. And if you want to dive even deeper into Generation Z and how they need to be led, please join us at the National Leadership Forum in 2017. And if you'd like some more information, please visit nationalleadershipforum.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us on the Growing Leaders Podcast.